Facing Russia's horrific imperialist invasion, Ukraine has put up a heroic and increasingly successful resistance. But away from the fighting, on the home front, it's facing a severe economic crisis. Today we ask what steps are needed to secure Ukraine's economic future.
It was unprovoked, but this is what Russian President Vladimir Putin unleashed on Ukraine. The sun came up this morning.
Some of the fiercest fighting is taking place around the eastern city of Bakhmut. It comes after the Kremlin declared its first battlefield victory in months.
Millions of Ukraine's children have had to flee their homes since the war began, with UNICEF estimating two-thirds of them are now displaced.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host Elena Ivanova. Our guest on today's show is Yulia Yurchenko, a senior lecturer in political economy at Greenwich University in London. Since the full-scale invasion launched by Russia in February of last year, Yulia has thrown herself into the global solidarity movement with Ukraine. Today we discuss the country's growing and increasing economic crisis and the neoliberal policies which are holding back Ukraine's war effort.
Hi there, this is Elena here. I'm now part of the Another Europe Is Possible team. But back in the 2016 referendum, I was just your regular politically active migrant pissed off that they couldn't vote. And so I was so happy when I found Another Europe Is Possible, because I thought, okay, this is a Remain campaign that isn't just putting the case for big business and the economic benefits of the EU, but where I can get active and argue for the things that I believe in and the real change that we could bring to the rest of the continent if we stayed in the European Union. For me, I think the European Union was a lot more than trade and tariffs and ease of access for business and big finance, although it's that as well. But I grew up in Bulgaria, and my opportunities to move to the UK 8 years ago to study and to change my life and to change my politics even basically came through membership of the European Union. So it's sad that we're now living through the Brexit that we warned about back then. But that's why we need to keep going, because none of the issues and none of the problems have gone away. And none of the issues are even unique to the UK. You know, the rest of the EU, the rest of the EU countries are still struggling with the same big questions around migration, around public ownership, about what real democracy looks like. So I think it is really important to be part of a network and part of an organization that is willing to open up to the rest of Europe on some of these issues. So that's why I think you should join us today. Go to anothereurope.org and you can get access to an extended version of this podcast by making Another Europe Is Possible your home too.
Hi, Yulia. Thank you for joining us today. Great to have this discussion with you under obviously very difficult circumstances. Could you give us a picture of just the general state of the Ukrainian economy right now?
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me in this podcast. The state of the economy is quite dire, as one would expect. The losses that in macroeconomic sense, in microeconomic sense, in also demographic sense, which also affects other aspects of economic activity, have been catastrophic. To date, the direct losses incurred through the damage to residential and non-residential real estate and other infrastructure amount to $135.9 billion. If we talk about the macroeconomic picture, the situation is worse. According to some recent estimates from financial institutions, about $349 billion will be needed to rebuild the economy. And of course, we're familiar, probably some of the speakers, with the Lugano recovery plan that was presented in the summer of 2022. About 175 billion euros at that point already was expected to be needed to rebuild the economy. By now, we must understand that that picture, of course, is significant. The picture is worse, and those numbers will be higher. And indeed, we can see different numbers floating around, not least because it is really difficult to accurately estimate the full damage that has already been incurred, especially in the areas where fighting is still ongoing or those that are under control of the Russian army at this point. On top of that, of course, on daily basis, Ukrainian infrastructure and residential stock and environment, countryside, agricultural capacity are being bombarded. And that all contributes to the accrued costs. Of course, one of the first questions that come to mind is how is Ukraine financing it, how it is still weathering this storm. And indeed, if Ukraine were left, if Ukrainian economy was left to itself without any external assistance, it would have collapsed by now. And Ukrainian economy has been heavily indebted by the time this most recent invasion has started, and even at the time that the first invasion started in 2014 with Russian annexation of Crimea. On the dawn of the most recent invasion last February, Ukraine already was one of the most indebted countries in the world, and certainly most indebted in Europe, and nominally and in real terms, very poor as well. So when the war started, a number of priorities had to be reorganized, including the debt servicing, and a number of additional financing streams had to be organized as well. And we have seen that aid come in from the United States and from the EU. Those were the biggest donors, and some bilateral assistance as well from other Ukrainian partners. To date, that aid from the EU and US combined amounts to about $100 billion US dollars, euros together. And that includes humanitarian and military assistance as well. In the recent days, we have seen the disbursement of the first tranche of a new assistance program that has been signed with the EU in the size of 18 billion euros for the coming year. The first 3 billion have been disbursed. And this is also the first package of assistance that will come with conditions on reform. It will be conditional on it. And those are loans with very long maturity that will, and no interest payment in the first instance, so that Ukraine actually can utilize these funds to help it weather the storm of the war, but also at the same time not be burdened by the interest payments of those loans. Debt with private bondholders has been suspended in the August of 2022, and that affected about 75% of all privately held debt. A lot of Ukraine's foreign debt is also held by Russia, which doesn't help. Some of that is Eurobonds that were issued as a form of a bribe to Yanukovych in 2013-14, just before he fled, in order to convince him, so to speak, to not sign the Deep Comprehensive Free Trade Agreement with the EU. That debt is currently being disputed in the UK High Court, and we are awaiting the judgment on the appeal on that. So there are a lot of very serious difficulties that Ukrainian economy is facing, specifically because of the unprecedented, on the world scale, pressures, economic pressures, humanitarian pressures, military pressures and needs, and of course the financing needs that have exploded since the beginning of the invasion. On top of that, there is something that very often when we think about macroeconomic figures doesn't necessarily kind of hit the top of the list, but it's absolutely fundamental, and that is the demographic disruption in the country. Almost 8 million people have fled the country as refugees to Europe alone. And of them, almost 5 million as of a few days ago, that's the recent UN numbers, are claiming some form of temporary protection or national protection schemes through Europe. In addition, almost 3 million refugees are recorded in Belarus and Russian Federation. And of course, those figures are actually quite tricky to assess accurately, and we do not know how reliable those figures are. And a lot of those people have been forcefully displaced. On top of humanitarian catastrophe and the demographic disruption and the labor force disruption that it creates for Ukraine, it comes with serious economic consequences. So dislocation of the labor force with specific skill sets, also extreme needs of specific types of professions to to assist in fighting the war, be it medics, be it care workers, be it infrastructure workers, those who maintain key energy and water supply systems. All of those professions, all of those professionals have been under an extreme stress and duress, which of course has also contributed to an already strained situation, and they've been underfinanced for many years. A number of enterprises since the beginning of the war have also relocated to relatively more peaceful cities in the west and the center of Ukraine, and now in kind of in the northern parts as well since the summer, and they have resumed their economic activity. A number of enterprises as well, and big oligarchic enterprises as well, have been paying their taxes up front through this year to help support the military needs and humanitarian needs in the country, where help and civil society and trade union organization around assisting the internally displaced persons who are more numerous than the refugees as well. And accurate numbers are difficult to assess because many people are staying with their friends and relatives. And if they are not registering for state relocation assistance, we do not quite know the exact numbers of them, but one thing we can say is that those numbers are very significant. The demographic, the humanitarian situation, the economic situation in the country are absolutely dire. The payments to internally displaced persons are minimal. Whatever savings people had are really drying up. A lot of the assistance to the front and to the displaced persons is coming through donations from abroad and domestically and from goodwill of people, because the state's capacity to support its populations, its small and medium enterprises, its employees is depleted. On top of that, the government, under the guise of assisting small and medium enterprises whose activity have been disrupted through the war, have adopted anti-labor laws in the summer of 2022, which have significantly undermined, technically completely annihilated, labor code protections from an overwhelming majority of workers who are still in the country or those who have fled. And those laws specifically affect the enterprises, small and medium enterprises with 250 and fewer workers. And they employ the majority of the workforce in Ukraine.
So, Yulia, what you've just described in terms of the macroeconomic framework, some of these numbers in terms of debt and loss to the economy sound incredibly dire. But for many of our listeners, luckily for them, they don't really understand what this means on the practical, everyday level. How is this crisis, this economic crisis, obviously caused by the war, experienced by people in Ukraine? What does this mean for everyday life, and how do people manage to cope? What are some of the informal systems that have replaced the support or the regular remuneration people used to receive from their jobs? How are people coping?
So we see this kind of all sorts of different protections being removed from people, their houses being bombed, their livelihoods being destroyed. And one thing that we don't see in the country is the introduction of a proper wartime economy that we are familiar with from historic examples, where the state takes control over key enterprises, technically nationalizes, either temporarily or altogether, of key industries. So a lot of the effort of supporting people came from people themselves. So we're talking about family and friend networks, NGOs, various civil society organizations, international donations and domestic donations, goodwill of communities where internally displaced persons were based, trade unions organizing support for internally displaced persons, but also to support to in evacuating people from dangerous zones, which was done completely for free. And it's been fascinating to watch, even though the conditions, of course, are very dire. A lot of trade unions have also given over their summer recreation facilities that they still have since their Soviet times to the internally displaced persons so that they could be housed and taken care of there. Members, individual members of different communities where people are based, have been bringing their food and clothes and toys and war and anything they could in order to support people who have been stopping there over on the way out of the country or have been stopping temporarily as internally displaced persons in those communities. So a lot of the brunt or a lot of the costs of this disruption and displacement, humanitarian and otherwise, has been carried out via donations and goodwill of organized and spontaneous support throughout the country. So informal systems of support that have sprung up have been absolutely fundamental in helping people weather the storm of this war.
I really appreciate you highlighting the point of just how vital for the survival of people support is, international support, of course, but also how much of the humanitarian aid has come from people on the ground, from Ukrainians themselves. I think we should never lose sight of that. I wanted to bring Luke into the conversation now. Luke, obviously, you've been doing a lot of writing and thinking on the issues of Ukraine's economy, its war economy and lack thereof. What is your perspective on all of this, on the current situation and how it impacts Ukrainian society?
Yeah, hi both. Great to have you on the podcast, Yulia. I very strongly agree with what Yulia has said, particularly I would just highlight the importance of the security environment for the economic environment. We know that first and foremost, Ukrainians are resisting the Russian invasion for political reasons, to protect their country, to protect their democracy and territorial integrity from an outright imperialist invasion. But their success in pushing back the Russian side also has this direct economic benefit too. So while the overall economic situation facing Ukraine is, as Yulia described, one of war-induced economic collapse, a really, really difficult situation, it would, of course, be much worse had the Ukrainians not successfully pushed back and resisted the Russian invasion. And do you see that in some of the sectoral impacts on the economy, particularly? So if you take an industry like steel, for example, which was very located around Mariupol, that has suffered a huge economic contraction. And of course, due to its Russian occupation, is now taken out of the sphere of the Ukrainian economy itself. So as Yulia said, there's lots of uncertainty in all of the data, but by some projections, it's thought that steel production in Ukraine government held territory has fallen by something in the region of 70%. But in other parts of the economy, there's a real story of perhaps surprising economic resilience. One estimate is in, say, in information technology and communications that have adapted quite successfully to the war. By October last year, the number of vacancies available in that sector was said to be approximately the same as the pre-war period. And on this kind of interpersonal human level that Yulia has also highlighted, you see lots of stories of this on social media, the way in which office spaces are adapting to the environment created by the war with this tremendous resilience and flexibility. And I suppose that also highlights, as Yulia also said and emphasized, that the mobilization of the people, the social mobilization and social organization of the people, is itself a factor in the success of Ukraine in prosecuting the war. That isn't a new idea. We've known that for a long time when it comes to conventional wars or political contests. It's something that the Prussian military strategist Karl von Clausewitz originally highlighted when he observed how in the Napoleonic Wars, the mobilization of society as a whole in order for one side to prosecute their campaign became a factor in successful resistance. And that's something we've seen in lots of modern conventional wars. And Ukraine has provided a striking example and illustration of this reality. Really, the Ukrainian government should be looking at this social mobilization of the people, looking at how, yes, trade unions are setting up, in collaboration with international allies and donors, humanitarian assistance for internally displaced people, how everyday Ukrainians are networking and mobilizing through civil society to support one another in this really bleak economic environment. And the government should be looking at all that social activity and thinking, how can we energize it? How can we capitalize it and grow and provide support to this social movement, which is underpinning Ukraine's military resilience? Brexit has happened, and many of the things we warned about are coming true, but no one seems to want to talk about it. Here at Another Europe, we say it's time for meaningful accountability and real scrutiny. And that's where our new project, Brexit Spotlight, comes in. We're breaking the silence and shining a light on the calamities. Find out more at brexitspotlight.org.
So I suppose over to you, Yulia, to give us your assessment. Is the Ukrainian government grappling with this question, and is it answering it in the right direction?
I'm very aware that the government and its ministers and the members of the parliament and various state agencies are under an enormous strain. I wouldn't want their job at this point. It's really difficult to meet the needs of the population, of the military, juggle all sorts of different economic and policy adherence dependencies that the country is under. But at the same time, I'm aware that it shall not absolve them of any sins, if you like, of that they're conducting in terms of economic policy. And it's important for us to critically engage with what they're doing, because this is a very crucial time for Ukraine society and for survival of Ukraine in every sense, of the word. Ukrainian population is paying the price for its survival, the highest price that any population ever can. And at this time, at the same time, I already mentioned the labor laws that have undermined the rights of workers. We see a lot of that. What we do not see instead is we do not see the introduction of the wartime economy that from history we know is something that works in the time of war. What that entails is government taking over control, either temporarily or altogether permanently, of key industries and enterprises should they be in private hands, and coordinating their functioning towards the needs of the military and the population. We have seen some examples of selective sort of show examples of that through this year, but they're so insignificant and are so riddled with internal political infighting that I don't think they're meaningful to even talk about. And that comes from the government and the president, who went onto their election campaign talking about de-oligarchization of economy, even at the peacetime. So it makes one wonder what exactly is happening in the country and why we do not see the takeover of these different enterprises, such as, for example, DTEC, big energy distribution company that's owned by Rinat Akhmetov, which actually was a lot of the enterprises that are part of that big concern have been privatized against the current, at the time of privatization, legislation on what can and cannot be subject to privatization. So we see that instead of a wartime economy, we have a war being fought with neoliberal means. And that doesn't work. It simply doesn't, and it cannot work. Neoliberal economics, austerity economics, doesn't work at peacetime, let alone at wartime. And we have seen that through the years of pandemic, different governments around the world, including in the EU, that were really strict with their fiscal compact, for example, in budgetary spending, have understood the importance of the state supporting society and supporting industry and various economic sectors in order to not allow the whole economy tank and people being able to, in order to allow population to pay their bills and put food on their table and buy medication. So we still see that that thinking somehow didn't sink in Ukraine and Ukrainian government. I'm not behind the closed doors of negotiations, and I cannot tell you with full knowledge what part of it comes from Ukrainian government and what part of it comes from Ukraine's international partners, but we do not see this happening. On top of that, we still see instances of corruption, especially within the judiciary, an attempt to rip apart and privatize the last remaining bits of the governmental assets. So that is very frustrating indeed. I want to also say a couple of words about the Ukraine recovery plan that was presented in Lugano. In its hundreds and hundreds of pages, we see a lot of very interesting things mentioned. So there are, if you look at the aims of that plan, and that, of course, is staged in, it addresses Ukrainian economy in stages of liquidation of damage, which is the current stage, and then, of course, rebuilding of the economy after the war and then making it a viable economy. So if you look at the domains of this plan, and it deals with the institutional architecture for smart recovery and recovery of infrastructure, deals with economy, environment, and society. Those are kind of five main domains that it deals with. It tries to address Ukraine's economy on the basis of seven principles. And I'll go through them one by one very quickly to tell you exactly why I think that the aims are great, but the means are not working. So it wants to, the plan works around principles of partnership, reform focus, transparency, accountability and rule of law, democratic participation, multi-stakeholder engagement, gender equality and inclusion, and sustainability. So far, so good. Sounds fantastic. But when you start digging deeper, you look at, for example, questions of gender equality and inclusion. Well, there is no talk about fully deployed public services and funded welfare state and expansion of that, or socialization of reproductive labor, or building more kindergartens, two-thirds of which have shut down since Ukraine became independent. You don't see any of that. You just see about having more women in the workplace without any meaningful plan of how to do it, or any proper support for care and childcare responsibilities financed by the state. Principles of sustainability equally. There is talk about smart technologies and, you know, renewable energy and all that. But there isn't a talk about investing into low carbon sectors such as care economy, for example, creative arts, the sectors that are low carbon from the outset. So this kind of deep principles of sustainability are not reflected there. Multi-stakeholder engagement is also really great. But as we've seen with the development of this plan, and indeed civil society organizations and trade unions were involved in the drafting of this plan, but their desires and needs are not quite reflected in the final text. So, and then the fundamental underlying problem with this plan is that one thing we don't see there is what we have seen was the biggest lesson from this post-Second World War restructuring and indeed of the world economy. And indeed, there is a lot of talk about modeling this recovery on the example and lessons of the Marshall Plan. But some of the things that we've learned from Marshall Plan is that without strong developmental state as an institution that directly finances different economic sectors, you will not achieve the recovery. And the developmental state is not here. Most of the financing and execution of the aims, delivery of the aims of this plan are assigned to private sector. And private sector simply will not deliver. No private investors will go into an economy that is war-torn. It simply is too risky for them. And half the time you can't insure those investments. But that's even beside the point. Ukraine is already borrowing through selling war bonds and otherwise, and will be borrowing more money internationally to rebuild the country. It only is logical that the country, the communities, and the people who have paid the highest price in every sense of the word for the preservation of the country should own and manage its key industries, should make decisions about what sectors to develop, what kind of needs of their communities are, how to manage various sectors, and have not just contribute their labor, but have full control and in execution and delivery of that plan. And that also was one of the lessons of the Marshall Plan, the biggest one that made it a success where it did. The recipient input, everybody who studies Marshall Plan highlights it, that recipient input, and it's not just about having people sat around the table, it's asking people what their needs are. We have already seen these informal networks that have sprung up, the desire of people to come back, those who have fled, to come back to the country and rebuild it. But for them to be able to come back and rebuild the country, they need something to come back to. And if you have the labor code that's ripped to shreds, if you don't have proper investment in kindergartens, in canteens, in healthcare, in infrastructure, in social housing, which is non-existent right now in Ukraine, then you will not have people come back. And if people don't come back, this plan is dead in the water. So I'm really hoping right now the Davos summit is underway. I'm really hoping that some rethinking around the fundamental principles on which the execution of this plan can be. I really hope it happens, because otherwise people won't come back and this restructuring simply will not happen.
Yeah. Luke, would you agree with Yulia's assessment about the thinking that's happening both within Ukraine and the Ukrainian government and these international frameworks that are currently being discussed and put in place? Are these the right lessons to draw from previous conflicts and wars?
Yeah, I agree with Yulia. You'll be surprised to hear. Yeah, I think where I would add is that I do think that there is a discrepancy between what some conventional international actors, I'm thinking here international financial institutions like the IMF and World Bank, that 20 years ago, 30 years ago, were of course critical to pushing the disaster of shock therapy on the post-Soviet world, and were committed very strongly to this ideology that markets left to their own devices and state retrenchment from many areas, all areas perhaps of economic activity, would deliver good outcomes. Today, we don't find them making the same assessment. And there has been a quite positive shift, I would say, in those international institutions over the last decade or so, because they now recognize that well-spent, efficiently raised and progressive taxation that funds strong public services and state institutions is critical to delivering positive development outcomes. So my assessment is that this push for this more neoliberal development strategy is largely coming from Ukrainian domestic politics and is ideologically motivated on the part of the government, because I think they sincerely believe, but wrongly in my view, of course, and our view, sincerely believe that any form of economic centralization is something that is associated with political authoritarianism. As Yulia said, this would be a problem in peacetime in terms of Ukraine's development, but it's a particular problem in wartime, because markets cannot function effectively in a situation of war. And the conditions, as Yulia said, for private sector investment in Ukraine are going to be incredibly volatile, not only for the duration of the war, but also in an immediate aftermath of the war too. Now, states historically have always massively intervened into wartime economies because of the recognition that markets aren't going to function effectively. How do you insure a building, for instance, if it could be bombed by a Russian ballistic missile? That's that the markets can't answer that question. It's something that needs massive and huge state intervention. And where that's been successful, such as the Allies in World War II, it's involved, on the one hand, very steep increases in progressive taxation, and including controls on private sector profiteering during the war. And on the other hand, huge state intervention into production in order to direct labor and capital to the needs of the war. And perhaps surprisingly, wars, when they're organized in that way, have actually been quite positive for economic growth, because the demands of fighting the war should actually be a spur to economic activity. Now, of course, as Yulia says, this isn't easy. For a start, it requires a hell of a lot of capital and money. And, you know, you wouldn't wish to be a civil servant in the Ukrainian finance ministry at the moment. Well, no one is saying this is easy. But Ukraine could be taking much bigger steps towards a more conventional war economy. In particular, they could be abolishing the flat tax system that they have. For the self-employed, the tax rate falls to just 5%. There's an additional war tax of 3%, so 8% in total, but that's completely flat. So it's completely independent of income. And of course, this creates a political problem, because if on the one hand, you're persisting with a flat tax system, if you're making only modest interventions into production in terms of seizing private sector assets in order to support the war, and if you're also reducing employment rights and refusing to talk to the trade unions, you're basically advancing a political economy model which says we're not all in this together, actually, even though we are all in this together because we're all fighting the war. We're not all in this together because we're refusing to construct a political economic model where the wealthiest Ukrainians are expected to pay the most and shoulder the biggest burden of fighting the war. So in terms of the risks of where this could potentially end up, I think we should be concerned. So at the moment, Ukraine is fighting a conventional war, and we know from history that conventional wars between two sides come to an end. They eventually end in some kind of negotiated settlement or a ceasefire. They stop. In other situations, and here I'm thinking of situations of intractable violence, so unconventional wars, whether that's those wars that we've seen in the Democratic Republic of Congo or Syria or South Sudan and Sudan over the last three decades, we should be, we've seen those wars where massive economic collapse, recession, combined with a neoliberalism and liberal economic restructuring, plus ethnic conflict and authoritarianism. There's basically a mix of factors, but neoliberalism and rapid economic liberalization has been a factor in driving violence, for the simple reason that war and violence can become a means of survival for rebel groups. So a kind of political economy of violence develops. I'm not predicting that that's going to happen in Ukraine, and there's tremendous countervailing factors against it happening, namely the huge support of the Ukrainian population for the democratic struggle to protect Ukraine from the Russian invasion and all of the societal energy that Yulia has highlighted. But it is really important for us to be raising this as a potential risk, that danger of intractable violence and political and economic fragmentation. That concludes this episode for those listening on the podcast platforms. Members of Another Europe get access to extra material as a benefit of membership. In this week's Extra Time, we discussed the role of the UK government and what it should be doing to support the Ukrainian resistance. Another Europe is the home of the pro-European left. You can join our campaign at anotherEurope.org/join.